Yes, this is good for us. All these little expectations, you know, when you get the snowstorm and half the folks stay home and you don't have the music that you normally have, and then all these little, it just kind of sets us all back a step, right? Because it's not about being slick. Oh, goodness, it's not about being slick. Thank the Lord. I know. For me, you know, you guys all know that, you know, my early days were in a home church, you know, completely stripped down, nothing of all of this stuff. So this is, I kind of snicker a little bit. So, in any case, we are in Philippians 2, the beginning of chapter 2. Paul writes, "If you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from His love, if any fellowship with the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others." The Word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. So this is one of a great example of places where chapter divisions are very misleading, right? The chapter divisions are not part of the original text, and we have to be careful when we have chapter divisions that we don't do the automatic thing of saying, that scene is over, now we're going to start another scene. Paul is, in fact, continuing the same thought that he's been speaking about. As we've seen through chapter 1, Paul's been speaking a lot about joy. He's been speaking about the experience of joy that comes out of hope, that the New Testament hope of knowing exactly where it is that we're going, of having that complete confidence that it's not under question, but that any day now this lie is going to pass away, and that we will be in the very presence of God, sharing in His glory. And that confidence and that knowledge really produces joy, unless we're allowing it to be waylaid and snatched away by the things that we do allow to snatch it away. And he's spoken about his circumstances. He's spoken about his whole ministry being taken away from him. He's spoken about facing possible death. And he's been making the point that none of these things have interfered in any way with his experiencing joy. And then if you remember last time, he was saying, at the end of chapter 1, he was saying, and you need to make progress, right? Philippians is the church where things were basically right. There was no major problem. But they still need to make progress. They still need to move forward. They need to experience more of that joy. And he said that he would know that they were making progress, that he would know that they were growing in their experience of joy, because he would hear that they had real unity, right? And that's the exact same thing that he's still talking about here. He's telling them, make my joy complete, okay? And the joy is such that he's speaking about them making his joy complete, but what he's really after is for them to grow in joy. He knows that if they cause him more joy, they will in fact experience more joy, right? We all, people who have been in close relationships, especially the marriage relationship, notice that there's the spiral that either kind of is going in one direction or in the other direction, where you're having that good week and you're nice to your spouse, and they're surprisingly nice back to you, and it creates that atmosphere where you want to be more nice, and the being nice to each other spirals back and forth, or the opposite happens, right? You wake up in a bad mood, and that puts the other person in a bad mood, and that puts you back in a bad mood, and it puts them back in a bad mood, and you spiral down until somebody gets sick of it enough to stop it. It's the same thing. Paul's talking about that he wants them to complete his joy, but he knows that this is what's going to cause them joy as well. And he says that he wants them to make his joy complete by being like-minded. Okay? And like-mindedness is not what a lot of times people think. I think that we correctly immediately think that being like-minded is being Christ-minded. Right? Being like-minded happens when each individual person is growing in the likeness of Jesus Christ. When each individual person is being transformed, when each individual person is having their mind renewed, is getting to know Jesus Christ, is being made more like Jesus Christ, that as we all become more like Christ, Well, like-mindedness grows, right? And we correctly understand that. But where we make the mistake, I think, is we think that as we all become more like Christ, that we'll just be more like each other in a human way. That somehow we start to lose our individuality. And that's not the case at all. Like-mindedness is not just everybody being the same. It's not even everybody just having the same opinions about everything. A lot of times people will take this idea and think of it in terms of, as we all grow like Christ, we will all become more politically in the same camp. As we become more like Christ, we'll all end up on the right side of the major issues. As we become more like Christ, we'll all look at the world through more and more and more of the same lens. And that's not the case. That's not the case. It's what's often people phrase it, you know, with the alliteration that unity is not uniformity, right? It's not. Because Jesus, God, and we can speak about Jesus because Jesus was present at creation, we were created as individuals. And the amazing thing is, as we each become more like Christ, we become more like what He originally made us to be. Right? We become more like Him, but at the same time, we also become more and more like ourselves. What we were originally made to be, who we're supposed to be. When God made, envisioned, because when He first made, of course, it was just Adam, but when He envisioned the world, peopled by people, He didn't envision them all exactly the same, right? And think of some novels where everybody's the same. Are those utopian novels or dystopian novels? You know, places like 1984, it's like Franz Kafka's The Trial. That's the most terrifying book I've ever read. You know, those twisted hell on earth worlds, that's where everybody's the same. That's where everybody sees the same thing. You know, you take the ultra conservative, the ultra socialist, Stalinistic places like Russia under Stalin or North Korea or China in the Cultural Revolution. That's the opposite of what the Lord does. When we actually become more like Him, when we're transformed into His image, we become more and more and more like ourselves. We actually become more individual. But we become individuals who actually fit harmoniously with each other. Right? We don't become the same, but we become fitted, well-fitted to each other. And that's the like-mindedness. Wald here describes it as having the same love. Right? When we're all looking at the same thing, when we're pursuing the same thing, when we have the same purpose, when we have the same spirit, both with a large S and with a small S, right? When we have the same desire, we're all in different places, but when we're looking in the same direction, that's the like-mindedness that Paul's after. It's not just everybody being the same. Interestingly, Paul bases it, right? He says, encouragement from being united with Christ. If there's any comfort, these ifs, by the way, are not ifs as maybe you don't have it, but if you do. They're if in the sense of sense. Since you have encouragement from being united with Christ. Since you have comfort from His love. Since there's a fellowship with the Spirit. This can also be translated fellowship in the Spirit. It's unclear whether he's speaking about your individual fellowship with God through the Holy Spirit or your fellowship together with one another by the Spirit. Since you have received this tenderness and compassion, he's basing the like-mindedness that we're supposed to have on what we have received from Christ. Right? These things that are being described, it's what we have from Christ. It's what He has done for us. The basis of the like-mindedness, the basis of the unity in the church, the basis of this way that we're supposed to function together harmoniously is what we have received from Christ. Okay? And this is completely opposite of the way unity works in the world. Right? When you come into any social group, whether it's, you know, you start a new job, or you start going to the YMCA in the mornings and you're interacting with a certain group of people every morning, or you know, as a kid when you start school, you enter into any social group. And have you noticed that every group has its own unwritten laws, has its own social structure, has its own little mini culture? And when you come into it, you have that period of adaptation, or that period when you're kind of getting your feet and figuring out, how am I supposed to talk? You know, what views are acceptable here? What do I need to keep to myself? What jokes do I laugh at here? What jokes can I get away with? And what jokes do I need to save for the other social group? Right? There's that period where you're starting to get the feel of things. And then on the new person, it's his responsibility to fit in. Right? And in the social group, it's always the people who've been there the longest, the guy that's worked for 30 years in that particular lab, or the people who've been there around there, that set the tone. Right? They're the ones that everybody has to kind of pay attention to and fit in with. And it's the exact opposite with the like-mindedness of the church. In the church, we're each and every one eager to yield. We're eager to take the same position that Christ took, and we're eager to yield. And the more mature you are, the more responsibility you have to actually yield to that and to make the other person comfortable. The grace that we've received from Christ, right, the encouragement, the comfort, the love, the tenderness, compassion that's spoken of, what is His attitude towards us? Right? And we often think of Him as a Father, right? But every time we think of a Father, we have to remember that He was not always our Father, that there was a time when He was not our Father, when He was our Creator, when He was our Judge, right? And at that time, were we looking for Him? Were we submitting to Him? Were we interested in what He had to say? Or were we turning away from Him? You know, at that time when we were turning away from Him, when we had no interest in Him, when we had no interest in listening to Him, that is when He was pursuing us. That's when He was encouraging us. That's when He was comforting us. That's when He had this attitude towards us, that He came after us. He extended grace to us. He was patient with us. He was ready to forgive when we weren't asking for forgiveness. Right? That attitude, if we recognize that that's what we've received from Him, if we recognize that that's how He's been to us, that's what we need to then extend to others. As new people come into the church, as people who've been in the church longer and ought to know better don't conduct themselves the way that we understand they ought to, as we yield to them, as we put up with them, as we extend that grace to them, as we're patient with them, as we overlook these things, and as we seek to just, when they don't deserve it, be encouraging, be comforting, be tender, right? We create that like-mindedness when we extend to others what it is that we have received from Christ. To do that, you have to recognize what we've received from Christ, right? People who've not really experienced forgiveness can't forgive. People who haven't really experienced having their debt just excused can't do that to others. People who haven't really received grace, people who haven't really understood that I deserved nothing, right? Or I deserved a lot worse than nothing. And Jesus gave me everything. He gave me Himself when He had no need to do that. When you recognize that, that's what puts you in a position to be able to do it to others. And when we give each other that grace, then the like-mindedness comes about. Because it's not just fitting in. It's not making other people see things the way that we do. That's how it happens in the social world, out there in the rest of the places. The new person comes in, and he slowly catches on, right? And the people who've been there longer indoctrinate him, you know, more or less gently or ungently. But that's not what happens here. Here it's completely the opposite. We yield. We encourage, we're patient, we put up with things, and in doing that, that's actually how the unity develops. Now it's tempting to think of it simply as like-mindedness is Christ-likeness. So I can ignore people and I can just pursue Jesus Christ and be like Jesus Christ and be transformed into the image of Christ, and then like-mindedness is going to develop. And if it's not, it's because you're not keeping up the way I am. Right? There's a real tendency to do it like that. But that's not it. One person can build the like-mindedness. One person, as they're becoming like Christ, can create like-mindedness. Because like-mindedness doesn't depend on your being ready to see things the way that I see them. It depends only on my being able to interact and be with you and walk together with you, regardless of how you see things. So it's a fellowship, but in a large way, to create it, it can be very one-sided. I can be at peace with you, you can be at peace with Joe, even if he's not at peace with you. You can be ready to tolerate him when he doesn't tolerate you. You can be ready to put up with his behavior when he's not ready to put up with yours. You can extend grace when he doesn't extend grace. So it's mutual, but it, at the same time, it's also one-sided. And I want to go back and kind of stress that it's not being the same, right? And being the same really is the opposite. I went out on a limb in the first meeting, and I played into a stereotype that's probably completely invalid. But I have this stereotype of some churches, and forgive me, in my mind, I refer to them as Southern. There's nothing... I've never been to the South, Cammie. I have never been to the South. I know nothing about Southerners. These stereotypes are completely unfounded. But I have this stereotype of the Southern church where everybody's the same. Right? And I don't know. This is probably not true at all. But everybody's the same, and everybody just kind of fits in. And, you know, if you don't fit in, then you go find another church. But wait a minute. That happens up here in the North, too, doesn't it? Oh, yeah, okay. But this is what happens. If you don't fit in, you go somewhere else. You find the church where there are other young families, or you find the church where there are other people from your social, you know, other people who work in the factory, or other people who are lawyers. People, we segregate ourselves, right? And we think that we found a church that's like-minded. But it's like-minded in a completely human way. And what we're actually doing is we're protecting ourselves. Right? We find a place where we fit in, and that makes it so that we don't have to be uncomfortable. We find a homogeneous group that protects us from having to change. We find a place where other people already see things the way that we do. We find a place where we don't have to put up with somebody with a completely different lens. We find a place where people are just as missions-oriented as we are. Which in fact means that I don't have to be hit up for helping my neighbors with heating this winter, right? We find a place where people understand these verses the way that I do. And what it is it's protecting. But the like mind, the human homogeneous pattern is a protection. It's a comfort zone. Whereas the like-mindedness that Paul wants to see in the church is the exact opposite. It's an openness, it's a yielding. It's a coming out of our comfort zone. It's coming out of everybody sees things the way that I do. I'm going to be in fellowship with people who see things the way that I don't see them, and I'm going to extend grace. And I'm going to be patient, and I'm going to really try to understand how they see things. That's what Paul wants to see. And it's interesting, again, he says that when he contrasts it, in verse 3, he contrasts this like-mindedness, and he contrasts it. If I were going to contrast, let's start from here. If I were going to contrast like-mindedness or this unity, I would come up with things like conflict, strife, right? Because I think of like-mindedness as being something between two parties. So then I want something else that comes up with two parties. But he contrasts it with things that are just one person. He contrasts it with selfishness, ambition, and vain conceit. Right? Self-love. He's contrasting this like-mindedness with something that is just one person. One person being selfish, one person being ambitious, one person being in love with themselves. Right? Which goes back to what I was saying a minute ago about this like-mindedness is something that depends on you as an individual. Whether the other person is meeting you in it or not, you can still do what Paul is calling us to do. You can be the one that enters into that like-mindedness. You can enter into that place where the body is really led by one mind, where the body really is one body and where there's one spirit. You can be there even when the other person isn't. Right? But what will keep you out are these manifestations of self. But so far, you know, all of this has been theoretical. All of this has been kind of imagine the church where there's this unity. And Paul is always concerned that we would have, you know, what can we actually do? What step can we take? You know, if we want to see more of this,
Right?
And we do need more of this. Because this fellowship, this like-mindedness, is more than acquaintance and it's more than good relationships. Right? He says, in humility, consider others better than yourselves. And of course, when he says consider others better than yourselves, he doesn't mean that we're just supposed to think that Craig is better than me. You know, and whatever it is I can do, I bet Craig could do better. He can, of course, but that's not what he's getting after, because you're going to come along, you're going to meet people who aren't better than you. You're going to meet people who morally aren't better than you. You're going to meet people who are nasty. You're going to meet people who've just made an utter wreck of their lives. And you're not going to be able to say, oh, yeah, well, as bad as he is, boy, I'm worse. I know I'm worse. If I say enough, maybe I really will think I'm worse. But, you know, I know I'm not. Right? That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about understanding that other people's needs are more important than your needs. That other people have a greater claim to whatever it is that's out there. Right? It's a good picture would be in the emergency room. Thank goodness I've never had to go to the emergency room, and I've never had to bring any of my kids to the emergency room. I've never been in an emergency room, but I've heard stories that there's often a line. You know, you can imagine people are in emergencies, and then they have to wait in line. And I'm sure that it gets very, very tense in there. You imagine somebody in there with a broken shoulder or something, and they're in great pain. Maybe they've been sitting there for hours waiting to be seen, and somebody gets wheeled in with multiple gunshot wounds, you know, literally bleeding to death. You know, you can imagine the person with the shoulder jumping up and saying, no, you wait in line. I've been here for 4 hours, buddy. I'm up. I'm waiting. I'm next. You know, we can't imagine such a thing, because there's that obvious understanding that this person's need is in a completely different category than the person with the shoulder, with the broken shoulder. And that there's a moral obligation for him to yield. That's the right thing for him to do. That's the mindset, for us to understand that other people's needs, that other people's situation is actually more critical and more pressing than our own. That's how we consider others better than ourselves. And I remember years ago I heard somebody, just kind of a one of these advice for your life to remember, is that when you're down, when you're frustrated, when you may be struggling with self-pity or whatever, you know, take a conscious moment to open up your eyes, to lift up your head, and to look around, and you almost are certain to find somebody else whose need or whose problem is bigger than your own. Right? And it's really, really, really true. And then when you open up your eyes and you get your head up and you find somebody else who has a more pressing need, you take care of them, you pay attention to them, and you will find your own need taken care of. And I would challenge you to try that. It is really true. You will find that your need will be taken care of when you open up your eyes and take care of somebody else's. That's what Paul's talking about here. This putting somebody else's need ahead of your own. That's what Jesus did when he took care of us. Right? He was putting our need above his own. Although we only were dealing with what we brought upon ourselves. Right? He was under no obligation. Paul also says, each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Right? He's just rephrasing what he already said about considering others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. And this would be a good exercise. I would actually challenge you to do it. This afternoon, you know, with the snow, the youth skating is probably called off, and so you'll probably have some time freed up today. You sit down, take a piece of paper, and think through your typical week. Not your stellar week 3 years ago when you were the spiritual hero of the world, but your typical standard week. And jot down how much of your time and attention are directed to the interests of others. Right? And it's kind of a little bit tricky to do, because there's always mixture. Things that we do for others, there's always some little element of our own interest in it. And even things that we do purely for ourselves, there's always some element of interest for somebody else as well. But as well as you can, separate that out and think about things that you do in the course of the week that are purely in the interests of others. And I think a lot of people may struggle to come up with anything. Or it may be a very short list, or maybe it'll be a long list. Right? But it's a great way just to kind of take inventory. Now, putting it back in context, Paul is telling us that by doing this, by taking care of other people, right, by looking after their interests, we enter into like-mindedness, right? Which sounds kind of nebulous, doesn't sound particularly attractive, but remember we said that like-mindedness is Christ-like-mindedness. All of us, because we're here, I know, are eager to experience more of the life of Christ. We're eager to have His mind, right? We know how our mind works, and we know what it brings about. It brings about death. We're eager to have the mind of Christ. We're eager to see things the way that He sees them. We're eager to be more united with Him. Paul's saying that one of the ways that we can do that is by actually just simply expending time and energy and attention on the interests of others. We always think, no, I'm going to go into the closet. I'm going to spend more time reading and praying. I'm going to spend more time in the Bible study. I'm going to transform my mind that way. And then once I'm like Christ, then I'll be able to go out and take care of other people. Right? But Paul's saying the opposite. He's saying you get out of your closet, you put time and energy and money and attention into really taking care of other people's interests, not your own, and you will find yourself transformed into the mind of Christ. You will find yourself becoming more like Him. And you know what you will experience? You'll experience joy. And you'll experience joy in fellowship with the others who are likewise walking with Christ. Now, the other thing I just want to bring out here is that when we're taking Christ as our example, right, which is what we're doing in this passage, when He took care of our interests, right, when He considered us better than Himself, it cost Him. It cost Him. We are often ready to participate, to give people a time and attention, but we're careful to do it out of our surplus. And then we wonder why it doesn't seem to have any spiritual impact. We take care of people. We try to love them. We try to extend grace. We try to meet their needs, but we try to do it from our surplus of energy and of time, of attention, of money, of emotional stability. We try to meet people's needs from our surplus. And then we think, why does nothing supernatural ever happen? Why don't I see God blessing this? Why don't I see this coming to life with the power of Jesus Christ? Because we haven't done what He did. He didn't do it out of a surplus. He did it to His personal loss. He did it so that it was painful to Him. He had to die in the process. And too often, we try to fulfill the letter of the law, but not getting into the spirit of it. We try to actually take care of others, but without it really hurting us. Because we get down to that point, and then self-responds, self-rebels, self says, whoa, that's enough. And we say, well, yeah, you know, we did more than some of the others, right? And we stop short of where it really begins to count. We have to do it the way that He did it. It has to be the taking care of somebody else's interest at the cost of your own interest. It didn't say to consider others way up there. Consider others better than yourself, right? That's where it's costing us something. And when we get to that point, which presupposes that we've used up all the surplus, right? We have to do what it is that we're doing, but then you have to do more. When we use up all the surplus and then we take that last step that finally requires faith, that finally requires a death to self, that finally requires us to turn away from something that we don't want to turn away from, that's that last little bit that finally makes it being like Christ. That's the thing that finally makes it doing what it is that He would have done. That's the thing that finally brings in the spiritual power of it. And that, in that last little step, where we take the real painful last step, that's where we will see ourselves being transformed, and that's where we will experience the joy. It's that fire that we want to get close to, but not too close, and then we wonder why we never get warm. Right? Christ-likeness sounds really good, but when we really get to it in life, we have a tendency to back off because it hurts. It hurt Him, and it will hurt us. But that is what we need to do. Amen.